Today on Hear Us Out, we're sitting down with guitarist and multi-instrumentalist Danny Black, a musician whose playing doesn't just support the song, it deepens it. It began with Danny's band, Good Old War. He has since toured and recorded with artists like Gregory Alan Isaacoff and Stephen Kellogg, bringing his skill and heart to guitars, pedal steel, and more. He's played some of the most iconic venues in the country, from Red Rocks to Madison Square Garden, and he's built a reputation as the kind of musician other musicians want on stage with them. We're talking about his journey as a bandmate, solo artist, and teacher, what it takes to adapt across genres and instruments, life on the road, and the joy of making something that just feels right. Let's get into it with Danny Black. Welcome to Hear Us
Thanks
Out.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So why don't we start off? You've had your own band. You've supported a wide range of singer-songwriters. How do you adapt your work to fit different musical styles and personalities?
That's a good question. I think really, you know, we're speaking a certain language. I've always talked about music as a language, and I think of it that way. So I don't really think it's necessarily adapting. Usually you end up in a room with people who want to play with you. So, you know, they have some idea or understanding of what it is that you might be able to bring to a scenario, or maybe you can surprise them, you know, with some good ideas. But in general, I think just being able to speak the language fluently is something that I'm practicing and always kind of working towards, and just trying to get more and more fluid. And so really just trying to stay in a situation where there's not going to be a whole lot of things that would come my way that I wouldn't be able to have something to say. But that said, there are definitely times where you get stumped and you're just like, well, I don't know what to say right now. But yeah, I think really it's just a lot of preparation, constant preparation, I guess would be the easy answer.
We've actually had the privilege of seeing you on a few of different occasions at Stephen Kellogg's shows. I feel like he does give you some advance warning that you're going to come on stage with him. But has there ever been a time where you just kind of improvised, you didn't even know you were going to come out on stage, perform certain songs, and you kind of had to figure it out on the spot?
Yes, that happens a lot in music. Actually, I recently went to see one of my favorite bands. They're called Blind Pilot. They're friends of mine, and they had asked me to come play a couple songs on pedal steel with them. And their opening act is a singer-songwriter named Dean Johnson, who I also really love. I love his music. And they introduced me to him, and I was kind of nervous and, you know, excited. And they were like, you know, Danny plays pedal steel, he can play with you. And so I had to almost immediately go on stage and play a song that I had maybe heard like two or three times ever before, and just improvise on an instrument that I'm fairly new at, you know, comparatively to guitar. And I find that stuff to be just the most rewarding. I think that's the most rewarding and exciting part about music, is those opportunities where you can sort of be like, how do I stack up? You know, do I have something to say in this situation?
We've talked before about how you are able to listen to something and I would say dissect it in terms of not just the chords that are being played, but what variety of the chord and where along a guitar neck is that being played. Talk about how your knowledge of the instrument and of what your musical counterpart is playing helps guide you in a situation like that, where you're just walking onto stage where you're not so practiced and prepped in a specific song.
Yeah, I love that stuff. Eric and I have talked about this a lot. I love that side of music. Sort of like, you know, how, you know, if somebody plays, you know, three quarters of a chord, can you finish the chord? Or can you, you know, just also, you know, knowing enough of the sort of the sound of, I call it, you know, just sort of relative harmony. So just understanding if they play one note, all the different opportunities that you have to play a different note off of that, or rhythmic opportunities can be both sonic and rhythmic. More than anything, it just comes down to preparation, and you just have to think like, okay, you know, breathe. No matter what they throw at you, it's probably something within at least a certain range that you might understand. I mean, there have been times where I've been like, that was too fast. I missed it. And you just hit a clunker, and it happens on stage in front of people, and it can be the worst. I mean, it happens in the studio too. And, you know, you go in and you get hired and you're expected to play great, and you just don't, you know, it takes you a few minutes to get into it. Eventually, usually these things work out if you've done it enough. I've definitely had times where I'm like, damn, I just did not kill that. You know, I'm not a robot.
When you notice that you don't hit it as well on stage, do you think the audience picks up on that? Or do you think it's just something that you and maybe the people on stage can notice, but that the average audience listener actually wouldn't be able to discern.
I hope the average audience listener wouldn't be able to discern it. I think I can't tell you how many times I've gotten off stage and been like, you know, not my best, you know, maybe could have played a little bit better tonight. And then, you know, you get on and another member of the band is like, that was the best show we've ever played in our entire lives, and vice versa. You know, we've all experienced both sides of that where, you know, we think we just had a horrible night and the crowd can't believe what they just saw. And it goes all the way into the, yeah, the people that you're playing with. And you really just have no idea. We have no true self-awareness up there. We're so wrapped up. And I can't, so many times too, you know, when things happen really suddenly, we play a show. And then at the time I'm like, oh my gosh, I'd never want to hear that. I probably hit 10 wrong notes. So, and you hear that, then we record a lot of the stuff. So I'll hear it a month later and be like, that was a great show. I'll have no memory of all the time, all the wrong notes that I thought I hit. Or, you know, once you disassociate yourself from it, it's kind of unbelievable how little you really are aware of what's actually going on and what you're actually doing.
So you speak about the idea of preparation, and it sounds to me like your preparation in terms of knowledge of the language of music is what you take into a situation where maybe you're not as familiar with the specific song. You oftentimes hear, whether it's athletes or pilots or people doing kind of high stakes work, that the preparation slows things down.
Yeah.
Do you find that because you have this knowledge that you're confident in, even when everything's moving so fast, are you able to slow yourself down in that moment to just kind of nail it?
That is such a great question. And I think, first of all, I just want to say, thank goodness I'm not in any of those scenarios where there is any kind of life and death or and really nothing rides on me playing the right note ever. And I think about that a lot, just being kind to myself and saying, nothing really matters here. You know, this is entertainment. This is just joy, pure, like, you know, expression. I don't have to worry about hurting anybody or hurting anybody's feelings. Even the people I play with, I'm not going to ruin their you know, the way that they're perceived if I go up and I don't play great. So there's really nothing on the line. It's just, you know, hope. You just want to create something special. So that's a really good thing to remind yourself in music, you know, just because you're not, there's nothing really all that serious happening. It's just for fun. Even though I take it tremendously seriously, that's just my own internal monologue. You know, I don't have to worry about hurting anybody in the long run. But yeah, as far as preparation goes, that is huge. And that's a really great way to put it about slowing it down. That's exactly what I talk about, you know, breathing. And you might have to go up there and deal with a new piece of gear that you've never dealt with. You might have to have a new cue that you just found out about right before you went on stage, or you might. And so really, yeah, you need to be, what I say is, you know, you play every single day so that the time, the actual tempo of the show feels like that tempo, and you can never be sped up. You can never be pushed out of your own rhythm, no matter what's happening out there. But it happens. Just as much as I like to say that, you know, I'm prepared, there are definitely times when I don't feel that prepared.
And sometimes it's really, I'm sure it's not even your fault. I don't know why I love asking this question on the podcast, but is there ever a time you've had where something went really wrong on stage live and you had to figure your way through it?
Yeah. I mean, that's actually, we were talking earlier about my band Good Old War, that we created a whole section of our show based on that, where I remember one time literally the power went out in a venue. We were not playing great venues at the time. We had just started and we played some, I think it was like a rec hall, some college show, and we had no idea what to expect and everything went out. Pure danger, right? We just turned it into, you know what? We're going to play acoustic. We're just going to walk out into the middle of the crowd, forget the stage, forget the audience, and forget all of the gear and forget everything, and walk out and sing our songs with the audience. And that became a huge part of our show. And also recently, on a totally different front, we played with Gregory Alan Isakoff. I played Bonnaroo, and it was raining like crazy our entire set. We were under a tent, and I played pedal steel. And I was getting shocked. I'm playing, you know, pedal steel, you're holding a metal bar. And I was getting shocked every time it touched the strings. And on top of that, I would create like a even worse current when I would put my face to the microphone. So I'm trying to sing and play pedal steel in tune in front of, you know, I don't even know, thousands of people. And it was being like broadcast on Hulu. And I'm going, nobody's watching me. Everybody's everybody's watching Greg. I just get through it. And I bet you if I heard that set now, I wouldn't even think it was bad. But at the time I was like, what in the world am I doing? Wow. This is way too hard.
And there were no plastic slides available.
That's why they call it a pedal steel.
Break the circuit.
Is there some comfort for you in thinking they're not really watching me? They're watching the front man. Is there ever comfort or relief in that?
Absolutely.
Do you ever want all eyes to be on you?
Yeah, a little bit of both. You know, there's times when you're like, dang, I just did something so cool. I want that attention, you know, but there's most of the time, I mean, I thrive in a scenario where I think this was really, you know, you discover your gifts or what you're made to do. I think you don't choose it. And what I was, I think, made to do as far as being a musician is to make other musicians sound good. And I am so thankful for that. I think that's the coolest job ever, is like to have somebody like Gregory who has this incredible vision and go up there and make him look like the genius that I believe he is, you know, and just sort of reinforce that to the people and just say, wow, like that guy's incredible. You know, this band is just making him sound even better, you know, but it's always about that.
In touring with Greg this summer or winter, it looked like you were playing a traditional acoustic, but as a lap guitar.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that and what you were doing?
Yeah, I could show you if you want to see it.
Yeah.
Really? Hold on one second. I love this stuff. It's so funny. It's like, this is really kind of very, very cheap way to do something really fun. I just bought this little piece that you put over the edge of your guitar. Can you see it? This metal piece?
So it looks like a metal nut?
Yeah, it's a metal nut. And all that does is raise the strings up too high for you to actually press any of the notes down. And then you just lay it on its side and you take a slide, just like any lap steel. And you can play it just like a steel. But really, this is just a, you know, maybe like a $200 Guild guitar that I, I have a bunch of guitars. I'm just a bit of a collector. So I just had one. I was like, you know, I've never played that guitar. And again, with Gregory, he doesn't tell us what to do. So it's really kind of like a choose your own, like, hey, come up with something cool and you'll get to play on the song. And that's really the way that the thing that I love about playing in this band is just like, if you can come up with a cool idea, something that he likes, you'll get your spot. And, you know, next thing you know, you're playing a solo on the song. So I'm constantly searching for interesting sounds and ways to find my way in. I mean, this is a 6-person band with 5 of the most amazing musicians I've ever heard in my life. I'm just honored to be there. So I'm just trying to, you know, find a voice in there. And this is the way. It's like, when you have Greg is actually an incredible guitar player, especially rhythm. So it's redundant for me to play more guitar. So I'm often finding new sounds and ways to play the guitar that, you know, aren't there already.
And what led to modifying a traditional acoustic guitar versus playing a pedal steel you have?
Yeah, I play pedal steel throughout most of the set. And then we move into a section of the show, usually at the end of the show, where we go around one microphone and sing songs pretty much unplugged. And that way, that was a time when it was like, well, you can't really bring your pedal steel to the front of the stage. It would just be a little bit difficult. Pedal steel is basically a piece of furniture that you sit behind. You know, it's almost like a desk. Yeah, you know, and which is funny that I ended up playing, because honestly, the reason that I started playing guitar was that, you know, I have very kind of hilarious hippie parents that would be like, play guitar, you can always be a hit at the party, you know, and that really rang true for me. And I think that we've talked about this too, about learning songs, like having such good ear training to play any song that anybody called out. That was really a huge part of my youth growing up, and just being that kid at the party who could say, anyway, here's Wonderwall, but actually play it, you know. And I love that stuff. So basically now it's just an extension of that, you know, just taking that. How can I just make people smile, or how can I make people enjoy something that I'm doing? And so I'm just on the search for new sounds and ways to make people smile and perk their ears up a little bit. It's really that simple.
And you bring up the idea of ear training, which is such a fascinating concept to me. And from our background in understanding physically and physiologically how the ear works, can you talk about some strategies that you've implemented for yourself to really fine-tune an understanding of what you're hearing?
Well, I'd like to know more about what you're talking about, to be honest with you, about how the ear actually works. I'd love to know physiologically why some of these things work the way that they do. I think really the main thing that I focused on is the idea of relative pitch. And then understanding kind of the relationship of notes, which is just so incredibly nerdy, but you can go so deep with it. And I talk about this to anybody who will listen, and I don't have a lot of friends because of it. I'm just kidding. But
we'll listen anytime.
Yeah. But I would love to hear what you're talking about, you know, physiologically why, because I bet there's a reason why the relationship of notes is so, does do certain things to you. It has this emotional resonance. When you hear one note going to the next in a certain way at a certain rhythm, I do wonder why that is. I have no idea why those things affect us the way that they do. It's incredible. And it's, again, I'm just so thankful to play music because of what it does to people in that way.
In kind of a simplified way of understanding it, if you think of the physical construction of the ear, the way that it anatomically exists, there are sensory cells that receive sound, and they're organized from high frequency to low frequency throughout the cochlea, which is the organ for hearing. And there are very specific cells for each frequency. So you're activating certain cells with certain sound. So when we do a hearing test and we play a specific pitch, a 1000 hertz tone, we're activating very specific cells within the cochlea. So if you're playing any specific note on the guitar, it's a very specific frequency that's activating a very specific region within the cochlea.
Wow.
So your musical intervals are going to remain true along the cochlea. So whether you're playing on a low E string, an A and a G and an F, or you're playing on the high E string, an A, a G, and an F, that spacing is going to be the same. The interval is the same. And your ear has the specific cells that are being activated for those specific sounds. So I couldn't tell you why some people just have a better pitch, why some people maybe have perfect pitch and other people cannot decipher one sound from another, assuming they both have normal hearing. But it seems like there's an ability to recognize which of those cells are being activated, and then what is kind of the interval one note from another in terms of how far away are the next set of cells that are getting activated from a different tone.
Wow. So if those cells are being activated by a certain tone, obviously we have extremely complex understanding of it. So we're able to hear many different things at the same time. Are all those cells lighting up at the same time? Is that the way that it works? Or are we actually only kind of hearing one thing at a time, but we think that we're, you know, are we perceiving more things at once?
So you're getting activation with those cells, then those cells are converting. It's kind of happening earlier within the ear. You have the acoustic wave going into the ear, and that physical energy is converted to an electrical energy from those cells that then send an impulse to the auditory nerve that then stimulate the region of the brain that responds to sound, and the brain has to interpret and decipher that information. So it could be that you're having this complex picture that's being sent into the ear that's being pulled apart and then put back together at the brain.
Wow. That's incredible. I mean, and then on top of that, you have an instantaneous reaction to it that has nothing to do with that. You know, so you're collecting the sound, it's being split up into a billion pieces, it's being put back together, and your body reacts to it at the same time. I mean, there's really, God, music is the coolest thing ever when you put it like that and you start to think about it. It's like, it's so ancient. It's so instinctual. That is just incredible to hear when you put it like that.
It just kind of generally in terms of sound, if you think about a time where you hear something and then you say what, and then half a second later you answer or you know what was said.
Yeah.
That's that actual brain processing time happening.
Wow.
That's what's going on there. It's almost like you're giving yourself a little buffer to be able to process that information you got.
That's amazing. Yeah, that is such a phenomenon. I feel like we've all experienced that a ton of times. Why did I just ask?
I wish I could understand perfect pitch.
Yeah, me too. I mean,
I don't
honestly
understand how that works.
Me neither. I mean, I feel the same way. Perfect pitch is a mystery to me as well. It's not, I mean, relative pitch makes sense to me. And that, because that can be learned. You know, and what I mean is, you know, perfect pitch is literally the ability to pull a note out of the air and know what it is. Obviously, you have to know what the notes are, so you have to associate it with a piano or whatever. But relative pitch can be learned by literally anybody, where you you hear a note, if you find out what note that is, then you can relate any other note to that. And that is something that is possible to be learned.
You know, so going back to what we spoke about a few minutes ago and how this tour you were playing pedal steel as part of the band, we spoke a few weeks back, a couple months ago, maybe with Robert Randolph, pedal steel guy, and he's always collaborating with different people. And we asked him, like, how do you find your space within a song to do what you want to do without stepping on the other musician's toes? And his response was, I'm always stepping on toes. So for you, when you're collaborating and you're trying to figure out what to do within a song, how do you find your space in a way that works within that musical conversation?
First of all, that's like the coolest response ever that he said. That is just so cool and really self-aware, because I'm sure we always are stepping on each other's toes. It's really also interesting to hear it coming from a pedal steel player like Robert Randolph, who is also an artist on his own. Because pedal steel, you're really taught, like, here comes the vocal. As soon as that's done, then you say something, and then the vocal comes back, and you get out of each other's way, and you're almost like a responder to the vocal. That's a big part of the language of the pedal steel in general that I've always been taught. But I think really more than anything, I think if you're removing the idea of it being you and what you have to say and what you have to get out, that's a starting point for any musician, I'd say. Forget about you. What does the song need? What does the music need? What is it calling for? Does it call for you to just wait? Or does it call for you to play something that's a harmony or a rhythmic harmony with something else that's happening? Should you just chug and hit something that's rhythm that makes a sound but isn't musical? Or is it time for you to shine right now? And really, again, it has nothing to do with you. And if you remove yourself from the equation, always, you're gonna find that people enjoy hearing you play more, because you don't need to get your moment. You don't need to get and express anything. You're expressing yourself by making the song better. And you'll find that in the end, you're always going to get a chance to get heard if you're truly expressing what's best for the song.
We are talking with an actor who is in Wicked on Broadway, and we are asking her about what it's like for her to go on stage and perform when she's not quite in the right headspace for it, or when any actor is not, their mind is preoccupied with whatnot. How do you navigate that when you might not be either in the mood to play, in the headspace, you're thinking about something else, but you have to go on and perform? How do you get through that?
Sure. I mean, I'd love to know what they said. I find that music is one thing I'm always ready to do. So thank goodness for that. I never have to worry about not wanting to play. That's never been an issue for me. There's never a moment where, like, honestly, I could be doing anything. I'm like, I just want to go play. But as far as like maybe not being in the mood to perform, or being in front of a bunch of people, or you're having a rough day on tour, you can get very tired and things can go well. Honestly, I always look at it like, again, this is maybe not the answer that you're looking for, but I would say, I'm doing exactly what I want to do. I am the luckiest person in the entire world. And anybody doing what they love for a living, it could be anything, needs to remind themselves of that constantly. And I don't have a hard time reminding myself of that. Like, I am so thankful for my disposition, I suppose, of just being like, hey, you play music. You know, this is all you've ever cared about. You were 10 years old making fake album covers for albums that you were supposedly making on a tape, you know, on a tape recorder in my room, just geeking out. You know, I've been doing nonstop. I've never thought about anything else. So I think really just reminding yourself, if you even have a glimpse of that feeling, reminding yourself of like, hey, this is what you love. This is what you want to do. This is what you've dreamed about doing. It would be a total disservice to everybody else who's waiting in the wings or wants to be where you are to even disrespect it for one second and say you don't feel like doing it. You know, because this is, this is a game of thankfulness every single day. I'm just so grateful for the opportunity. And again, like, you know, we're talking about having something to say. I don't care. I'm happy to be here. I want to just make something great every day if possible. You know, obviously
such a good answer.
You try. Thank you.
seems like a lot of the people that we've spoken to who really have success within their industries, there's a humbleness about it, that recognizing there are other people that are contributing to your success. You're part of a team, you're part of an organization that is all striving for this one specific outcome, and you doing what you need to do and the other people doing what they need to do lead to everybody's success. And it's kind of what you're describing as well.
Yeah. I mean, being in a band is like being a puzzle piece. And if you think of it that way, you're like, oh, well, I'm the corner, you know, and this thing will not, you cannot create this thing without the border. And, you know, you have to think of yourself as whatever part you might be at any given moment and realize just how cool it is. I mean, what a miracle it is that you can all do something different and that creates this whole, especially like, for instance, recently we did a tour with a symphony where we were doing symphony tours. So we were playing with the symphony of every city that we would go to. And somehow, miraculously, they can have the sheet music in front of them. And it's as if we've played together our whole lives. You know, they just read this thing. And our band, who has been playing together for a long, long time, we can play perfectly with this 70-piece orchestra. I mean, music is incredible. It's an unbelievable phenomenon. I'm just never going to get over. I'm just so fascinated by the whole thing.
Yet, is there ever a time where you'll do a collab and it just, like, whether it's your musical styles, the way you go about music, that it just doesn't quite fit?
No, it doesn't. Maybe we don't create like the best song ever, but no, I've been, again, I feel like if you're sensitive to one another, I've never really experienced not fitting with anybody yet. That said, you know, that could happen, but also, you know, personality has a lot to do with it. And yeah, like you said, you know, just humbleness and going in and saying, well, what do they want to say? You know, if I'm the collaborator, or, I mean, I've definitely asked people to come play on stuff of mine or something that I was producing or something like that, where I'm like, well, that piece didn't necessarily work, but that's no fault of theirs. That could just be like a misunderstanding of the person's vision or my vision at that moment. But no, I think creatively, you know, something amazing can happen at any given moment if you're open to it. You know, I haven't experienced a whole lot of things not working at all.
Do you have a preference in the creative process of kind of being in the front where you're playing versus being on the back end of production?
Yeah, I think you need a healthy diet of both to respect the, and this is maybe part of what makes some people good collaborators, is that, you know, okay, I've been that person up front and I can do that, you know, some days, and then I can step back and support someone else. And if you have enough experience doing both, that's very helpful in being considerate to the artist. If you, you know, especially now I find myself more and more being a sideman or a collaborator or somebody who gets hired to play on people's records, just saying, okay, well, if it was my record, which it has been, what would I want them to do? And then, you know, you want to give them exactly what they want with just a little bit of surprise. That's what I find as a sideman most of the time. Give them exactly what they were hoping for, but maybe push it up. Just, you know, turn the volume up just a little bit. You know, not literally.
You've performed at pretty large venues like Red Rocks, and we saw you, I believe, at Bowery Ballroom and in Long Beach Island.
Great.
Where, like, I'm not even sure if there were
tiny
50
room.
People there.
Yeah.
It was tiny. Do you have a preference on the excitement of the large venues where it's huge, there's a crowd, there's lights and action, versus those really tiny but more intimate settings?
Yeah, you know, it's hard not to be affected as somebody who grows up in the music world and wants to do certain things and accomplish certain things, not to be affected by the glitz and the glamour of playing a place like Red Rocks or any arenas or things like that. And that is exciting. But I honestly have had just as incredible transcendent moments in house concerts as I've had in the biggest venues, you know, in the world. I'm lucky to have gotten to play rooms of all sizes and get to say that. But if I'm being totally honest, I think the best sounding rooms, the place where the music that I love sounds the best, is somewhere around 500 to 600 people. It's my favorite place to play is a place called the Fox Theater in Boulder. It's like, you know, it's maybe 500 people and it just feels perfect because I play, you know, maybe folky rock music a lot of the time. That's what I tend to get hired for the most. And it's where I, you know, the world I grew out of, that music sounds best there. Whereas, like, I mean, everything sounds great at Red Rocks. Don't get me wrong. You can't really go wrong. But maybe not in an arena. You're sort of like, oh, I hope we fill this place up. And I hope it feels, you know, all these other factors that have nothing to do with music come into play when you play those bigger places. So I don't know. They all have their charm. But I, like, I've had moments where I did my own little house concert tours when I was first starting to do solo work that were some of the best shows of my entire life. And still, I, you know, hold them up there as some of the best times I've ever had playing music. You know, whereas, you know, you would expect me to be like, oh yeah, like the biggest shows ever are it. But it's really, it's every night you have the opportunity to do something really special and you just have to be present for it, I think.
In those bigger settings where you're also working with the front of house mix, you're working with the monitor engineers, how do you make sure you're getting what you need in your mix in a way that the monitor engineer can deliver that to you, knowing that there are six people in the band and everybody's going to have different wants and needs? How do you manage that for yourself in those relationships with the support personnel on a tour?
Yeah, there's a lot of tricks to it. I mean, it takes a lot of time. A good set of in-ear monitors for us a lot of the time, for sure. And we have an amazing engineer who is really helpful in that. So I can't take any credit for that. But you start to develop some tricks. You know, I would love to know why this works. Maybe you could explain this to me. I tend to do a lot of panning. So I take somebody, like I would take my another backup singer's voice and put it over here so that I can hear my own voice in my right ear. I like that. I'm not sure exactly why that works. Or I just sort of move things around panning wise, instead of moving them around volume wise, I can generally have everything almost near the same volume. Obviously, I keep myself just a little bit louder so I can make sure I'm in tune. But a lot of the time, it's really a game of panning for me. And I do also have a little button where I can press and I can talk quietly to the engineer and say, hey, I need a little bit of this. But most of the time I spend, cool. I use that button to say, I love you. You're doing a great job.
See, I bet Michelle would be the better one to answer that question because she deals with auditory processing.
Yeah, please explain. I'd love to know. I mean,
No. I got to think that one through.
I mean, well,
good question.
Can I ask you this? I've heard, and I don't know if this is true, that your sort of sense of pitch of your own voice comes more from the right ear. Is that correct?
Maybe he's talking about how the different regions of the brain, like the left side of the brain is more in tune to like language. The right side of the brain tends to be more music oriented. So I don't know if it's specific. I don't know if it's specifically the right ear. Definitely the more right side of the brain handles the music side of things.
And then there's crossover where information from the left side processed on the right, information from the right side processed on the left. So that could all be at play there. And I'm thinking about what you're talking with panning within your monitors. If you're creating more separation, then it's making it easier for your brain to process that complex information. That the more overlap the sound is, the harder it is to separate out what you want to specifically hear in a moment from what you don't want to hear in a moment. So if the monitor mix is able to separate that more effectively, then that could potentially give you what you need in any given moment.
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, I don't know why these things work the way that they do. This could be such an interesting conversation if I wasn't being interviewed and I could interview you guys and ask you.
Start a podcast.
I think it would be a lot more interesting if I was asking you questions, is really what I'm getting.
I don't know about that.
Music is clearly a very hard business to break into. Is there any advice you would give to aspiring musicians on either how to break into the business, how to keep going when it seems like, it sounds like your parents were very supportive of you and it was never a question that you were not going to go into music?
Yeah.
You always were. So how do you convey to aspiring musicians how to keep going? Because there's a lot of rejection in the process. There's a lot of being told you're never going to be able to do it. How do you get past that?
Yeah, well, I'd say, first of all, like the thing that is really kind of disheartening about the entire business is that why isn't it a viable career path like anything else? I mean, if you consider the amount of music that people are constantly taking in and using for various reasons in their lives, for entertainment, for therapy, for so many reasons in our lives, we're using music, maybe just passes time. There's so many things that we can use it for. It kind of baffles me that it's not a viable career path, because it's totally something that people use every single day, almost as much as we use our own our own language. You know, we're talking about music, we're listening to music, we're constantly digesting new music. So I'm still kind of working that out in my brain as to why it's so hard to break into it as a career path. But as far as, again, my upbringing, I wouldn't say I was more supported. I just never gave anybody else another choice. You know, there was just never there was nothing else I could do. I love a lot of other things, but there was nothing else that was ever going to capture me. I was never going to be able to sit behind a desk. I just can't sit still unless I have a guitar in my hands. It's not doing any, this isn't a choice. So I'd say, like, if you want to break into the music industry and you want to make it a career for you, be open-minded about how that happens. It's not going to happen the way that you'd expect. You know, yes, you can dream of, like, one day I'm going to be under the big lights, but you might find yourself in a studio. It's never going to go the way that you expect it to go. And you really have to be open-minded and relaxed and kind of let the lazy river take you where it will and just try to get good at every skill that gets put in front of you. So if somebody's like, hey, you know, I know that you want to be the star, but you're much better as, you know, as the bass player standing in the background, you have to be like, that's going to help me get in and that's going to teach me something, then I'll take that gig, you know? And so that's really a huge part of it for me, has always just been like, yeah, I'll say yes to that. I'll say yes to that. I'll take any opportunity that I possibly can. And whenever an opportunity was given to me, I said yes. And I sort of figured it out later. So there's always been times where somebody will say, can you play this? And you're like, yeah, totally. And you're like, oh God, I have a week to learn how to play that instrument. And now that instrument is something I play. So, you know, that's another thing, is like, be really diverse, be really open-minded. Things go, let the chips fall however they may, and try your absolute best to find yourself and your own version of you within that. And just also, like, people say this about, like, marriage, or, like, you know, how do you get a marriage together? It's like, don't get divorced. That's kind of the way it is with music. It's like, just don't stop. Just don't give yourself any opportunity or any other way out or any backup. And if you do, get out of the way. If you're willing to do something else and get yourself, you know, give yourself a backup plan, maybe get out of the way for those people that have no other opportunities. You know, there is nothing else available to them. Like, honestly, if I could be making $0, I could have no success whatsoever, I would still be doing the exact same thing. I promise you, nothing would change.
I want to go back to something that you had touched on earlier, where you were curious about the way music makes you feel certain things. And a lot of your instrumental work, what I find within it is, hey, what feeling are you looking to feel? Well, that's the song I'm going to pick for that. And that instrumental is going to elicit this for me. When you're in the process of writing instrumentals, can you talk about that process for yourself and what it is you're kind of internally going through as you create those songs?
Yeah. I mean, there's a million different ways to make music, and you try your best to stay creatively inspired. There really isn't one way. Sometimes you could just, you know, play something that sounds a certain way. You go, oh, that sounds like driving really fast. I'm going to follow this. Or you can say, I'm in love. I'm so deeply in love with this person. I just want to write a song about that. And that happens too. And maybe you can convey that with or without words. And if you can, that's the cool thing about instrumental music, is like, maybe this means love to me, but it means breaking up to someone else. It's such a beautiful, cool thing about music. So like with my instrumental music, I try to stay like really specific for me, and then really, really just like as open as possible for the listener. I try to give them just whatever I want to put in it, but I try not to say like, this song is about this, because that's, again, one, especially with instrumental music, something that's so beautiful where it can mean anything to anybody who hears it. And that's such a cool thing about music in general. I mean, I've heard that with songs that have lyrics where people are like, this song helped me get through the breakup, you know, the worst breakup of my life. And you're like, this is like a song to my wife that I'm telling her that I'm so thankful for. You just have no idea how things are going to affect someone else.
Everyone has their own interpretation.
Yeah, it's so beautiful.
Any gigs coming up that you're particularly looking forward to? What's on the horizon for you next?
Yeah, well, with Gregory, we have a lot going on. We're going to do a short tour with Mumford & Sons this summer, and that's going to be really fun. And then we have our usual kind of fall tour in Europe, but every year at Labor Day weekend, we play two nights at Red Rocks, and it's just hard not to look forward to that. It's just exciting. Music is just, I mean, to get it to take you to this place. And again, another thing I think that's so cool about going to a place like Red Rocks is that I get to bring like my family on stage at the end of the show and show them what I saw. And I think that's like the coolest parts about getting to play those awesome places is kind of getting to show what it might feel like to the people that are standing in the audience going, wow, this is so crazy. I can't believe they're playing these places now.
Do you struggle at all with the air in Colorado?
Yeah, a little bit, but I've gotten used to it over the time. Everybody in our band is from Colorado, so I've spent so much time there. I think my body seems to have figured it out at a certain point. But yeah, there was definitely times where I'm like, God, this is brutal. You know, you're carrying around those oxygen tank things.
It would suck to be a horn player in Colorado.
Oh, okay. I mean, I wonder about that. You know, I'm a sports fan. I was watching the playoffs and the basketball playoffs. I'm just going, you know, every day they're going back and forth to Colorado. I don't know how they would just do that. How you can just go to Colorado and play a basketball game. Seems insane.
Yeah. I certainly felt it when I was out there, and I could not imagine playing for hours at a time, just kind of hopping into the city, playing and leaving.
Yeah. I don't know how most people do it. Again, I'm lucky because we spend a lot of time out there because the band is from there. But yeah, I've definitely struggled in the past for sure.
So an interesting thing that we've touched on with other guests has to do with AI and the effect of AI with sound and how that's incorporated with music production and kind of growing ways these days. Is that something that you see as a positive, as a negative, or just kind of is the evolution of life that there's change?
Yeah, I think you kind of said it. What can you do? You know, nothing is inherently bad or good. And also, I mean, remembering that like AI, all the information that it's gathered is from us. So, you know, if you're going to think of something to ask it to do, it's going to be some version gathered from a whole bunch of different sources that were human at some point, you know, or coming from a human place. Even when it expands beyond us, which it probably inevitably will, it's going to still be gathering information from our human experience. There really isn't in the long run any kind of way that it can replace us, because it's still going to need, you know, more information from us at all points. But I don't really know how it's going to affect us enough to be like afraid. You know, I wish I could say like, I'm scared because this specifically is going to happen. I have no idea how this is going to play out, but I've definitely seen some really cool things about it. And I've seen some pretty horrifying things where it's almost uncanny how human some of the things that it's capable of creating. It's nuts.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
So my last question for you is, one of the questions that we tend to ask on the podcast is, if there's a time you can recall where you became a part of somebody else's story. So with us, we've had our patients where there might be a patient that we have more of an effect on or that stood out to us over time with different musicians we've spoken to. If there's been a fan, an audience member, a bandmate where you seem to have some sort of lasting effect on them, or there's been some sort of crossover that stuck with you with them. Have you had any of those times where you've had some sort of effect? They've had an effect on you. You've had an effect on them that's made you kind of feel good.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think really early on, I noticed with my band Good Old War, some incredible experiences. We had a thing where we would, again, go to people's houses sometimes and play shows. It was just kind of like a way of connecting with fans, you know, in between tours and meeting some of the people and some of people's experience with the band. I remember meeting this family who had lost a child, like a teenage son, who we were his favorite band. So we would come we came to their house to play a show for them. And, you know, I can't even imagine how that felt, because the family had bonded over our music. It was the one thing, I think he committed suicide, something really just horrendous, I mean, unspeakable. And we got to meet them and play music for them and play these songs that were his favorite that they all knew because of him. That was, again, I don't even have words to explain that, because you're literally singing about your girlfriend, you know, and you're thinking about how just silly your emotions are and how deeply you feel them when you're writing a song sometimes. And you have no clue that you're actually, you know, creating moments with people that that are just so much deeper and so much bigger than you'll ever understand. And again, I just, it's a credit to the beauty of what music really is. It just, it's so massive what it is capable of doing and how it brings people together. And, you know, you go to a festival and you just see people with their hands up and it's just these religious experiences. I just can't believe I get to be a part of that. That's what attracted to me in the first place to it. And it's something that I really hope and pray that, you know, as I get into my older, and I don't hope I don't turn into some sort of like old Republican angry guy, as you know, in my old age, and I can continue to feel this empathy towards whoever feels excited about something that I've had the good fortune of playing on or writing.
So why don't you tell everybody where they can find your music, where they can connect with you and keep up with what's going on with you and with the different projects you're a part of?
Yeah, pretty simple. Instagram, you can find me, Danny Black. And on Spotify, on any of the music places where you listen to music, my music is there under Danny Black. Also, Good Old War was my band. And I play with Gregory Allen Isakoff, Stephen Kellogg, Alexis Cunningham, who is an up-and-coming songwriter who I write the songs with and play most of the instruments on her record and do all the pertinent stuff. So many, hopefully more and more, I'm constantly playing on people's records and writing songs with people. And that's, as long as that keeps going, you're going to be stuck with me. I'm sorry.
We love awesome. It. We love it. Really, thank you for coming on, Danny. We really appreciate it. I can tell from talking to you that you live, breathe, and love music.
Absolutely.
And it inspires us. Eric and I both play music. Obviously, you know a lot about Eric and his guitar playing.
Yes, I do.
We appreciate speaking with somebody who loves it like you do, because you keep us going. You keep us motivated to want to keep doing it. So thanks for coming on, for chatting about your musical journey. And we can't wait to see what it's coming next.
Well, thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. We really appreciate your time and you sharing your stories with us.
Absolutely.